Hey, Dan, how are you, Dan?
Hey, Josh, how are you doing?
Doing okay.
Good. Okay, just to introduce myself, I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I blog at danieldresner.com.
You want me to introduce myself, Dan?
That would be nice.
Good. I'm Josh Cohen. I teach political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford University, direct the program on global justice there, and I'm also editor of Boston Review, actually co-editor with Deb Chasman of Boston Review.
Well, I'm sure you're probably missing your former haunts in Boston right now. As I write this, there's approximately 18 inches of snow outside my window.
Is that right? Is there really?
Oh, yeah, we got blanketed over the weekend.
I see. I have a particular interest in this because my daughter is flying back to Boston today, and I don't think she knows how much snow she's
She should be fine in terms of getting in, but it's good she wasn't flying over the weekend. Otherwise, she would have had a hell of a time.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not. I confess that I'm not absolutely missing that. I know that comes
someone
as
who
a
went
shock.
To grad school at Stanford. You know, well, as someone who went to grad school at Stanford, this is one of those days where I wish I was back in the mothership.
I see. I didn't realize that you went to school out here. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not a bad place, although.
No.
You know, it's that it's that special time of year. Term is over. Papers are graded, and there's the end-of-term ritual of trying to decide what to do with the students who've plagiarized in the course. I don't know if
yes, now it sounds like you've had some interesting plagiarism cases.
Well, this year, each one is interesting in its own way.
I do appreciate the subtle ironies of that line.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, this one... This hasn't happened before. I say interesting in its own way. For example, I had once had a student who plagiarized an entire PhD thesis, and that I mean all of them are sad in a way, or many of them are sad in a way. In that
wait,
case,
you mean they handed in the dissertation and it was entirely plagiarized?
Handed in a dissertation and I would say it was 90% plagiarized. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah. It was very unusual. And then when I
discussed
this with the student, she told me that the voices had made her do it. So that's one way in which it's unusual. Another time, I had a teaching assistant in a course. This is when I was at MIT, and he came to me and he said there was something odd about the paper, and he wasn't sure like if it was worth like an A plus or a B minus or something. But there was something odd about it, and he showed it to me, and it was immediately obvious to me that it had been plagiarized from John Rawls's lecture notes. I was going to grade the TA down. But this time, what was unusual this time was that the student plagiarized from me. So there was a lecture of mine that I had given at MIT as part of a course, and now is online under a Creative Commons license. And I gave a lecture this year, and it was about 80%.
Well, and that makes it okay. Wait, doesn't it? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. It was okay to have read it without paying for it. Right,
right. Yeah.
Right. But it was completely plagiarized. And I've never had a student hand in a paper that was plagiarized from me before, but what do you
how
do?
Big was, I have to ask, how big was your class, the one that where the kid did this?
So this one had about 180 students in it, so the paper was not submitted to me.
Okay,
but there
this
were two
makes a
issues.
Little more sense then.
Except I'm not the when I saw the place that he had gotten the lecture from, it said at the bottom that it was. From a lecture that I had, it wasn't obvious to me that he knew that he was plagiarizing from me.
Yeah.
But there were two possibilities. One is that he knew it and he thought he was submitting it to a TA who maybe wouldn't know it,
right?
Or he was unaware of it. But what do you do when you this happens to you too? I guess. I mean, I'm not a magnet for plagiarism. I don't think. Maybe
this has happened to me periodically, but I have to say I tend not to get worked up about plagiarism, and
yeah.
I think not that I mean it's not like I condone it or anything,
right.
But my observation is there is a very strong correlation between people who are stupid and people who tend to plagiarize, which is to say usually the people who are pretty smart enough to write decent papers then don't plagiarize. Now maybe it's that they're so smart that I don't pick up the plagiarism. Which
right.
is possible.
Yeah.
Maybe this is me being
you've
lazy.
Got a big selection problem.
No, I grant there's a selection effect possibility.
Yeah.
That said, you know, the cases that I have caught have always been cases that are so frigging obvious that that you know, there hasn't really been an issue. And then I think here I mean, at Fletcher, part of this also is that it, because it's a large international student body, that actually makes it a little easier, because usually if someone is plagiarizing, it's obvious because their English is dramatically improved.
Right, right. Well, I'll give myself credit by way of saying that this student's writing was drastically improved by having plagiarized from my life. At least the structure of the paper was improved. But but you say you don't get worked up about it. What do you do when you discover that?
I mean, if I catch it, I flunk the student, and I usually will, I'll notify the dean, and you know, we'll go that route.
I count that as getting worked up about it.
I'm sorry. I don't get by worked up, I mean, I don't get, I don't start ranting about the students today and, all of that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, this is not a crisis of culture or anything like that.
Right.
I agree about that. It's probably...
I think the last time I got really worked up about this, and this was actually, this bothered me, this was back when I was at Chicago, and there were some PhD comps there.
Yeah.
And I was grading the comps. I caught two different comps giving the same answer. And I have to admit, this is one of those gray areas where the problem was that the students were not ordinary. These are students who were not planning on going and getting on, going out of the academic track. But also, it's not clear whether this was an innocent mistake or not, where they had common notes and they wound up just cutting and pasting. I think it was much less innocent than, let's say, some of my senior colleagues there believed.
Right.
You know, that was...
I'm just remembering, I actually faced another case of somebody plagiarizing from me. I'm laughing about it. It really wasn't very funny. This was a dissertation that had been submitted for an American Political Science Association prize, and I was on the committee that year that was reading the political theory theses. And there wasn't a lot that was plagiarized, but there were a few paragraphs that were, just word for word from a book that I had written that this guy had actually presented a paper on at APSA. And the thing that was in a mode of true confessions, the thing that I found most disturbing about it was not that he plagiarized from this book that I'd written with Joel Rogers on democracy, but that he plagiarized. There were a couple of paragraphs that were word for word, and we didn't appear in the bibliography of the dissertation, which had many items in it. But I actually have my view is, I think, different from yours. First of all, I don't associate it with, as you call it, stupidity. And I don't think of it as laziness. I think usually, in most of the cases, I think it happens out of desperation. I mean, somebody is just way behind, and they don't know what to do, and they're stuck, and they're looking around for something to do, and this is something they stumble on. My attitude towards it is I've never turned anyone in for it. I deal with it myself. I have a kind of we all screw up. These are 20-year-olds, kids. Be forgiving about it. The main thing that I do is make the person, if they're going to pass the course, I just say, okay, so you handed me something that you didn't do. Now you're going to, if you want to pass the course, you have to hand in something that you did do. So, it's...
Wow.
You know,
so wait a minute. Let me get this straight. Yeah. Someone can actually plagiarize from you and still pass your class.
They get an A+. No. Yes, they can still pass the class because I say, now go and do the work. There's a very heavy embarrassment factor. The thing, I have to say that I've never been given such, having taught it to, very elite institutions all my life, first MIT and now Stanford, and now observing in the current period of financial disaster, the world of Madoff, the utter, unbelievably disgusting corruption of the high-flying American elite. I'm wondering if I've been too forgiving.
This is your fault, Josh.
It is my fault.
Now I'm beginning to realize it, because all the financial wizards in Wall
Street... How could this have happened? Well, now we know.
All the financial wizards on Wall Street probably have PhDs from MIT. I'm sure at some point they took your course.
I've been an enabler, a professional
this
enabler.
This is the secret seat? Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, no, I'm being semi-serious about it. I do worry a little bit that now, that, you know, these are very, very... successful, you know, they're kids, but they're very, very successful. I'm sure they believe that they can do whatever they want and get away with whatever they want. There is an embarrassment factor to being caught and having to, you know, apologize for it. And but on the other hand, there isn't really any beyond that. There isn't any penalty. Attached.
See, I disagree. I mean, I am a little bit of more of a hard ass. I mean, yeah, my take is, you know, I'm not, you know, they made this choice and they will pay the repercussions. The repercussions will come in a bad grade, which is the one thing they can't erase, you know, from their record.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I don't deal with this as much now. I think being at Fletcher, I only teach the graduate students. So I don't have, I don't deal with the undergraduates on this.
You know, the one last anecdote about this, there was a kid who, I want to be careful, I don't want to give away too many details of it, but there was a kid who plagiarized, and he actually was a graduating senior whose entire education had been paid for by the Air Force. He was an Air Force ROTC. Yeah. He was a wonderful kid who he was in this very desperate situation, and he became an Air Force. Without going into the details, he was on an Air Force base during Clinton's second term. And one of the things that I said to him was that you know, when somebody did something like this, and he was in, you know, he was in command, he should keep in mind that he had fucked up too, and you know. Keep that in mind as he was trying to decide what to do. Anyway, he said that during the Monica Lewinsky business in the late 90s, he was the only one on his Air Force base who didn't think that Clinton should be impeached. And I guess it had something to do with his the lesson in forgiveness that I had given him.
That's fair. I mean, I you know, I don't necessarily want to, you know, expel a student for this kind of thing, but I do think a black mark has to, you know, in other words, there does need to be a cost to be, you know, a price to be paid, and it has to be a little more than just embarrassment.
Than just embarrassment. Well, yeah, but I think people respond differently to embarrassment. Anyway,
that's true. Speaking of which, though,
it's a sad. It's a sad issue. It's a total pain in the ass. To have to deal with it, and it's unfortunately a little more pervasive than any of us would like. But
yeah. And the web has probably, unfortunately, made it much, you know, and then we can talk, I mean, the web has obviously made it a little bit easier, which is regrettable. But speaking of potential, you know, embarrassments, Condi Rice is heading back into the Academy.
Yes, Secretary Rice is, I guess the expectation is, although people are sort of cagey about it, but the expectation is that she's going to be returning to Stanford this winter.
She actually hasn't been cagey, but I saw her on Meet the Press yesterday, and she said explicitly she was going back to Stanford and Hoover in particular.
And Hoover in particular, yes. Some of us say that's not part of Stanford, but anyway, of course it is very much part of Stanford. So she's going to be coming back here. It's an odd case of, I mean, the usual way that universities handle you know, faculty members being away for extended periods of time is that they either require that they resign their position after a couple of years, or that they go through some kind of reappointment process if they want to come back. This was the story with Henry Kissinger having been away from Harvard for 2 years, or Stan Fisher, the MIT economist, was away for 5 years from MIT,
right,
and then he eventually had to resign. But so far as I understand, there were no – Condi has been away for 8 years from Stanford, and there were, so far as I know, no restrictions on the time that she could spend away, which I think is a little – there's something inappropriate about that, I think. I mean, you know, and when you're an academic, there are some things that you do. You teach and you do research. And, of course, if you're a political scientist, you do, I'm sure, learn a lot that's relevant about politics by being national security advisor and secretary of state. But it's a very different kind of business from the business of doing research. So I think it was, in my own judgment, it was inappropriate for there to be this, take as much time as you want and then return attitude. Though I suppose the fact that she's coming back to Hoover rather than to a regular academic position.
Well, I was going to say, is she going to have a position? Will she still have a line in the department?
Well, so far as I know, she had this. As you could imagine, this is not everybody's favorite topic for a whole variety of reasons, including lots of people don't feel very good about it, and nobody exactly wants to talk about it. So, let me put it this way. When you walk into Encino West, where, as you did for some time when you were here, and you look at the pictures of the members of the political science department, Condi's picture is still on the wall. So I think she still does have a line in political science. Nobody's expecting her to be coming to a lot of faculty meetings. Of course, she wasn't doing that when she was here before going to Washington because she was the provost out of the department for a long time. But one of the things that's also, getting closer to the complexities of the matter, I discovered recently that Stanford rules are that there can't be any kind of disciplinary action against a member of the faculty who does something, who engages in criminal activity. Prejudging the answer to that question. I'm just saying what the rule is.
Okay.
So if you've done something, and I really don't mean to be prejudging that question. I'm just saying something about the rules here that give some structure to the discussion about it. It doesn't matter what you. So for example, if you commit sexual harassment in your office while you're teaching a course, there can be the provost can initiate a disciplinary action against you. If you rape a student, you rape somebody on the street in Palo Alto.
Yeah.
That is not a basis for disciplinary action.
Hold on, let me write this down in case I ever go over there.
That's the Stanford rule. It's not the same rule at other places. You should check the Tufts rule. So, for example, at MIT, you can get in trouble as a faculty member for criminal activity that you've engaged in that bears on your fitness to serve as a member of the faculty, even if it wasn't criminal activity that you engaged in while you were a member of the faculty.
Okay.
And the same thing is true at the University of California. So, if John Yoo teaches at Bolt Hall now, there's a very strong statement defending the appropriateness of his being a member of the law faculty there by Chris Edley, who's the dean of the law school. But it's also true that the University of California has a rule that if there were a criminal prosecution, that would bear on his the appropriateness of his continuing to be.
All right, let's try to ground this a little bit more on Condi. First of all, no one is accusing – she's not going to be brought up on charges for anything, nor is there evidence that she should be for that matter. So – this is really...
Well, I think the issue is about the... I mean, she ran the principals' meetings discussing interrogation methods in 2000... Mm-hmm. excuse me, in 2002 and 2003. Mm-hmm. Now, she did not have, as Rumsfeld had, a kind of command responsibility.
Yeah.
She has said repeatedly, and I entirely believe this to be true, that she was... asking Ashcroft and others from the Office of Legal Counsel for, about whether or not the methods of interrogation that were being considered were legally permissible. Of course, it was part of the legal culture of the Bush presidency that an enormous amount of pressure was put on the people who were doing the legal analyses to say that anything goes, which is more or less the John Yoo position,
right.
That anything goes. But she, I think that, the, I don't think anyone thinks that there's any kind of legal issue about her role in the run-up to the war, arguably exaggerating the state of the evidence on weapons of mass destruction. I think very arguably on the nuclear piece of that exaggeration.
I think you can absolutely accuse her of using overblown rhetoric. I mean, the line about the mushroom cloud. You know, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. You know, obviously that was, very, inflammatory rhetoric. But, God, I mean, we'd have to indict all of Washington if that was the if that was the standard.
I agree. Well, I don't think that there is any legal issue there, although it doesn't make me very happy to have her as a colleague, because I do think that she does have more responsibility than other people outside the administration who are mimicking the kind of things that she said and that President Bush and Vice President Cheney said. But I think there's an issue there that makes me uncomfortable. But I think the torture war crimes issue, I think it's a complicated question about what the lines of responsibility were. But I just want to emphasize that she was the person who was chairing the principals' meetings, including these were the meetings that Ashcroft was going to and basically saying, why are we talking about this in the White House? You know, history is not going to look kindly on
this. I would say this. I actually had to write a review of the three Condi biographies that have come out since she became Secretary of State. Yeah. And one of the things that comes out reading those is the extent to which that, you know, the fact that she chaired the principal meetings really didn't matter that much, because an awful lot of the decision-making that was done took place outside the venue of the principal's meeting. And that was indeed one of the biggest problems of the first term of the Bush White House in particular. And, it's partially an indictment of Rice's management of the NSC, but mostly I think it winds up being an indictment of Bush because this was the way he wanted it run.
Yes. I think that's important, and I agree with you about that. And I have a very unsettled position on this. I don't feel very comfortable about her being around, but on the issue about whether or not there's even a marginally plausible case of legal responsibility or partial legal responsibility, I don't know. I'll just say this, though. At the principals' meetings, agreeing with everything that you just said, at the principals' meetings, there were all these discussions, very specific discussions about method, about permissible methods of interrogation. And there's no evidence that I know of, but that's maybe me rather than what evidence there is or may turn out to be, no evidence that she raised any of the kinds of objections that were being raised by lots of people who were involved in these discussions, Alberto Mora being perhaps the most striking example, somebody who took very strong exception and pushed back very hard against it, but also people in the FBI and lawyers for the services. And now she's not a lawyer, but there were lots of people who were very, very uncomfortable about this stuff. And, you can take the position, as, a bunch of people do take, that if we do it, it's not torture. Torture is illegal. We do it, it's not torture.
Right.
But there's no evidence of there having on her part of there having been any disquiet about that or having pushed back against it. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there were some kind of serious investigations into this. There is just the Senate Armed Services report that came out.
The Levin-McCain report, right.
The Levin-McCain report.
I would say a couple things about this. The first is that I would encourage you, if you're a member of the department, to, I actually am probably one of the few Stanford products that actually had Condi Rice as a teacher. I was, in between her NSC 41 stint when she became provost, I took comparative politics with her. She was undoubtedly one of the best teachers I had at Stanford.
I don't doubt
she's
that.
A fantastic teacher. Yeah. So I hope that she does, express an interest in teaching and that, she can do it without, get the protests out of the way basically the first day and then actually teach, because the students would benefit. But, going beyond that, my take on this, I think, is that I would say two things. First, I mean, you know, you've seen Jack Goldsmith's book on this, right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
Jack, you know, one of the things I think Jack does so well in that book is point out that what happened crossed the line, but he also gives an explanation for why it happened. Among other things, the fact that all the policy principles kept getting this, you know, after 9/11, kept getting this threat matrix where every single threat, documented or not, was on this list, and this was the sort of environment that they were reacting to. And in some ways, I think, you know, I've talked with Jack about this, and I think he probably agrees that it was a mistake in the end that if prior to 9/11 they erred in not getting enough of this information, they erred post 9/11 in wanting to, you know everything. And as a result, because they looked at everything, they wound up overreacting. There's no question about that. The second is my suspicion. My suspicion is that Condi's position on this probably is very similar to, I don't know if you read this, Ross Douthat at The Atlantic wrote a very interesting post over the weekend on the torture question, where he, again, without question, acknowledges that, you know, this was wrong and, it was something that America should not do. But that he feels some measure of guilt about this because probably at the time this was happening, he wanted the U.S. government to do this in the belief that it would make him safer. Now, I think that, I mean, it's a remarkably honest, I think, you know, statement by Douthat, and I think, frankly, covers probably what a mass majority of Americans felt at the time. But that said, you know, I will agree with you. It doesn't let the policy principles off the hook, because the policy principles are presumably supposed to remember the fact that the Constitution is around and are, in fact, not necessarily just supposed to go with the will of the people, but remember their oath of office as well. Right. So, I mean, it's a complicated... Yeah. It is a complicated
There's
situation.
There's another
it's
piece
not
of this that I don't... I maybe, you know, you've read much more of this stuff than I have, and this is just rank speculation on my part, but, you know, it's speculation that comes from thinking about the people involved and the kind of natural human emotions. My sense is that a bunch of the people in the administration probably had a very serious sense of guilt about what had happened on September 11th.
Yes.
I mean, they can, you know, talk till they're blue in the face about the amount of intelligence they were getting, and, you know, it all seemed like noise and very little like signal, but you look back, the message is coming through. There are people like Richard Clark who are saying, hey, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention.
Right.
And they weren't paying attention. And I think it would be, you know, it would be almost unbelievable if a sort of, you know, even marginally, you know, humanly decent person who was in a position of power in the administration didn't have some sense of guilt and then be driven to, you know, a kind of overreaction. And I say that even, you know, I've said this to people who said that I'm making excuses for them. And I mean, whatever, I don't care if I'm making excuses for them. It's, I think it's an important part of the piece, but I just want to also say though, let's reiterate something that I mentioned before, which is, there were lots of people, who were involved in positions of power, who, you know, potentially at some cost to themselves, and I'm thinking of Mora in particular, pushed back very hard against these policies. So it's not like everybody was freaked out and everybody lined up and everybody was marching in the same direction. They had to push back hard against the people who were resisting the policy. So anyway,
I think that's true. Although, I mean, memory serves, you know, the people who pushed back primarily, interestingly enough, were lawyers.
I think that's right.
In some sense, this is not to excuse what others did, but if you're not, you know, that is the job of lawyers to say what is and against the, you know, what is legal and what is not. But if you're a national security person, you know, and I've seen this, you know, you don't care necessarily about the legal niceties. You care what is the, you know, policy that is going to maximize what I want to do.
Right. And you think it's somebody else's job to worry about the legal niceties.
Exactly.
Right? The only piece of that, and I have no idea if Condi was involved in this at all, but the only piece of that story leaves out is the amount of pressure that was coming down from the Cheneys and the Addingtons.
Addington is the clear exception here. Yeah, and you know, there were the Addingtons and the Hughes, who, to be fair, you know, they didn't make this up. I mean, they came up with a legal doctrine that said, we think this is the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, and every you know, description of Addington in particular that I've heard about, this is not someone who just says we can do whatever we want. This is someone who actually just has a rigorous view of what the Constitution allows and believes that he is right.
Yeah, I don't doubt that he believes that he's right. That's the problem, not the solution. Yeah. Anyway, it's going to be, I think it's going to be complicated, and I wish, and maybe this is just in a kind of unseemly, dirty hands way, I wish Condi weren't coming back, but I wish there were some way to have a discussion about this, you know, torture and war crimes issue.
Well, I mean, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't Don Rumsfeld now a senior fellow at Hoover?
That's not exactly. No, what happened was it's going to sound even worse, but it's actually not worse. There was some task force that was being set up, and I think George Shultz was probably involved in it. And they decided that it would be a good idea to have Don Rumsfeld involved in this thing. So he was appointed, this is where it sounds worse, a distinguished senior fellow or something like that, but I think it's a one-year appointment. I don't think he's been...
Oh, it was an honorary.
And he's not been on the campus at all, whereas I was walking across the campus with a colleague a couple of months ago who pointed to a corner of Hoover and said, that's where Condi's office is going to be. So I expect that she's going to be around and there'll be a lot of fanfare, and I think it's not... The thing about her involvement in the principal's meetings on the methods of interrogation really does bug me. But, well, more than bug me.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I would disagree with you. If Condi wants to come to Fletcher, I would certainly welcome her with open arms. I mean, there's no question that there are, her career as national security advisor was not a glorious one. And you can argue that, certainly she committed, mistakes in terms of the handling of the policy process. But, I mean, the question about the detainees, she's probably like, the 200th person that I would be concerned with in terms of the responsibility for that sort of thing. The fact is she also, and again, this comes from reading the biographies, it was clear that she was, relatively speaking, a voice of reason in the Bush administration and was responsible for, some of the major course corrections that took place in the second term in particular. For all the talk about how, oh, thank God, Obama's going to be elected and we're not going to have to deal with George W. Bush, the Bush foreign policy of 2008 looks remarkably different from the Bush foreign policy of 2003.
No, I expect that she's going to be, she's going to be, greeted as a returning hero for having kept us out of war with Iran. And I think that's not like, you don't have to, be on Mars to think that there's something to that. I just think it's all going to get exaggerated by the desire to, be nice when she returns. And I agree with you that she's not in the core of people, and she may not even really. I'm honestly be in the periphery of people who bears responsibility for these policies. I'm very much unsure about that. I just am concerned about the fact that she was chairing these meetings, that there was no evidence, and with very detailed discussions of interrogation policy, specific methods of interrogation, including mortar
boards. Well, one of the things, Condi, in my experience, does not lack for debating skills. I mean, hopefully one of the things that would come out of this was that, in fact, Condi will engage with some of the people who are her critics at Stanford. And my guess is, hopefully we'll have a productive dialogue.
Well, we'll see. We can.
But this relates to the question of, how to deal with the detainees. Boston Review, you just published an essay by, name is blanking me now.
David Cole, Georgetown law professor. And he's the Nation legal correspondent. I think that's his official title. Who's been a very big critic of detention policy Guantanamo,
right. But who nevertheless, to sum up this quickly, proposes in the article simply a mechanism whereby we are allowed to detain suspected terrorists until, you know, hostilities are declared to have been ceased. That basically what he proposes is not, he dissents from the sort of Goldsmith proposal of creating a new kind of court to deal with these national security issues, but rather says, look, during wartime, you are allowed to detain people without trial, you know, when they're suspected as an enemy combatant.
I wouldn't put it quite that way, because...
Okay, go ahead.
He doesn't think that there should be a detention for suspected terrorists. The idea is that he does think that there should be a preventive detention should be.
I'm sorry, preventive detention.
Preventive,
yes.
Detention. The question is, who should it be for?
Right.
So one group of people, including Jack Goldsmith, thinks that there should be a new category of preventive detention for people who are suspected of terrorism. There are other people, Joanne Mariner, for example, from Human Rights Watch, who's one of the respondents to David Coles in the Boston Review, thinks you want to stay away from preventive detention, period. David's point is that if you're fighting a war, and you capture a soldier from the other side, you can hold the soldier. You don't have to try them in a court of law. You can hold the soldier until the end of hostilities. But the detention is it's not for somebody who's suspected of doing something or who might have supported the doing of something or was the grandmother of somebody who said something to somebody about doing something. It really is for people who have been involved, who have been fighters, who've been involved in conflict. So it is for it's preventive detention for military combatants, and making the case that the people are military combatants requires, among other things, that there be some kind of congressional authorization of the conflict.
And declaration of war.
Either a declaration of war or one of the modern equivalents of a declaration of war, you know, kind of Congress going along. Now, this Cole's position on this is to defend preventive detention, basically for enemy combatants. That's what this is about. With a narrower construction of who the enemy combatants are, and a more strict set of procedural safeguards in the detention process. This proposal, I think, came as a surprise to a lot of people because Cole has been such a sharp critic of the detention policy. And I think a bunch of people took this as a signal of something like, you got a bunch of stuff that Bush has been doing, and people have been, pardon my language, pissing all over it. Obama's going to do a bunch of stuff that's not so different. And now what's happening, this is how it's been read, and now what's happening is people who are supporters of Obama are lining up to explain why it's okay and how it's different.
Right.
I don't think that that's the right understanding of what Cole has done, but I think if you would ask them 6 months ago, you know, is David Cole for a try them or release them policy of using just criminal methods of criminal law for Al Qaeda or Taliban fighters, or is he for using a preventive detention approach? I think people would have thought that he's for try or release, but
I will say there are times where I think this issue, the perception of divergence of opinion has sometimes been overly magnified on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was at a conference, I think this was 2004 actually, and this is when, you know, things are really starting to heat up about Gitmo's post-election, and I was listening to a panel where it was John Yoo on one side, and I want to say Nadine Gordimer on the other, from the ACLU. Thank you. Yes, Nadine Strossen, that's right.
The lawyer, not the writer.
Right. I apologize to both Nadines. And what struck me when I was listening to the two of them was not the extent to which they disagreed, but rather the surprising extent to which they agreed. And this was, you know, this was startling. As someone who only occasionally, you know, reads up on this issue, it was startling to me the extent to which they actually, their positions overlapped, surprisingly. Yeah. And so one of the things that I suspect is going on is a recognition now by some people of, oh my God, there actually is less divergence than people realized. You know, and I think, I mean, Cole mentions that even in the first paragraph that, you know, everyone wants to shut down Guantanamo.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of the, you know, regardless of the legal issues, the political symbolism of Guantanamo is such that it has to be shut down.
Yeah. Right.
So I think that's partly what's going on. With regard to the intrinsic merits of Cole's proposal, I mean, on the one hand, I suppose, it's worthy that, you know, he's clearly taking a political risk in doing this. I think, though, the problem with what he's proposing, and it's not necessarily clear if there's a solution to what I'm about to say, but I think in some ways the debates on this issue are really trying to merge two different questions. The first question is, what do you do with people you capture that are linked to al-Qaeda? And so it's how do you handle the current detainees, given that you've got a war on, you know, that you've essentially declared war on al-Qaeda, but it's a face, you know, it's not it's not a traditional state-based enemy, and the end of the war isn't in sight. That's issue one, and I think Cole deals with that relatively well. Issue two, which he does not address at all, and this is, I think, the big downfall of this, is what do you do if there is another terrorist group out there that is plotting an attack, and you suddenly have actionable intelligence on that? That's a separate issue, and I think part of the problem is that when the Bush administration was devising all these things, what they were far more concerned about was the second point than the first.
What I don't understand... go ahead. We'll finish it.
No, and so, I mean, in other words, now you can argue, no one will make this argument politically, but you can actually, I think, make the case that because of the way things work, you are simply going to have to be in a situation where the prospect of that kind of 9/11-style attack from a different group is going to happen before you then declare war and then go through these procedures.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that is a trade-off, and it's just, I think, worth raising.
The thing that I'm not getting about what you're saying, I mean, I agree with you that that's a situation that you have to be concerned about, but there have been lots of cases elsewhere, in Britain and elsewhere, where that's been exactly the situation, that the people have been kind of caught plotting, and that's what criminal law is for. So I don't know that you need a new category of preventive detention for, you know, for the suspected terrorist in order to deal with that kind of situation. I mean, you might, but I think I think this is partly Cole's point, is that before you go down the road of expanding the category of suspected terrorists, expanding the category of people who are subject to preventive detention beyond people who have actually been fighting to suspected terrorists, you need some reason to think that the criminal law
is inadequate to the test.
Is inadequate, and it's been pretty adequate for lots of cases. I mean, I think that, you know,
True? I mean, I ask this question out of ignorance, but my assumption would be that particularly when you're dealing with attacks that have yet to take place, the tension between revealing intelligence versus, you know, trying someone in open court have got to be pretty significant.
Well, you asked the question out of ignorance, and I'm answering it confidently out of ignorance.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I shouldn't be so confident in my assertions. I don't mean to say that you can't. Let me be clear here. I don't mean to say that it's obvious that you can use criminal law methods for handling concerns about plotting. You know, where you may be worried about revealing, methods of intelligence gathering or intelligence that you've gathered. But I mean, I'm making two points. Number one, that's the case that has to be made, that you need preventive detention rather than ordinary criminal law methods for dealing with that. And secondly, that I think in making the case that you need preventive detention for suspected terrorists rather than ordinary criminal law methods, what you'd have to do is to show that the concerns about revealing either methods of intelligence gathering or intelligence itself can't be dealt with in ordinary criminal law procedures. And The fact is that there are lots of criminal law devices for finding ways to bring information to bear in a trial that don't, without revealing it to all observers. So that's the kind of case that would have to be made. I mean, this is these are some of the reasons, I should say, why Joanne Mariner from Human Rights Watch, who's a respondent to Cole in this Boston Review debate, which is online, some of the reasons why she's resistant to Cole's proposal. Eric Posner, who's one of the other respondents, on the other side, thinks that Cole hasn't gone far enough and that you really should be going in for a more, capacious regime of preventive detention, including for suspected terrorists, because the technologies of conflict have just extended, expanded in ways that make ordinary criminal law methods inappropriate for dealing with current threats. It's an important debate. I think Cole is trying to mark out an intermediate position that basically says treat combatants in this war that's not a war between states, treat them in just the way that you would treat combatants in a war that is between states, where preventive detention is entirely appropriate.
And I don't necessarily, I don't think I have a problem with that. I think the problem is it's an incomplete solution. The question is whether there is such a thing as a complete solution, and I'm not sure there is, actually. And I have to say, speaking for myself, I think we're far enough removed from 9/11 such that I actually will say that I would probably be willing to take the cost of the kind of attack, a 9/11 scale attack, rather than try to set up the kind of security apparatus that would allow for the kind of prevention, preventative techniques that might prevent, that might stop that sort of thing, but in the process have all kinds of type 2 errors where you detain people who are not planning anything.
And you do. I agree with you about that. You won't be surprised to hear. And also, I think it's not like the people who you're going to detain who weren't really doing anything wrong are going to be some random group.
Maybe. Look at this way. I say that, but that's not an easy thing for me to say. And I think there are a lot of people in this country that would take the opposite position.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I thought the more interesting the essay that you published in the Boston Review was the one by, and I'm going to massacre his name, so I'm sorry, Steve, Steve Ansolabahir. Is that right?
Steve Ansolabahir, yes.
Ansolabahir, damn it.
Ansolabahir, yeah.
Josh, did you ever see this skit that the Harvard poli-sci students put together about a year ago called The Office?
No.
Oh, it's a great riff on, it was like The Office, the show on NBC, but it was in the political science department at the Gov department at Harvard, and the end joke is someone trying to pronounce that name. That's why I bring this up. Anyway.
Well, Steve was a colleague of mine for many years at MIT, Steve Ansolabahir, and he wrote this piece with Charles Stewart, who's currently the chair of political science, and it's about the 2008 election and the outcome of the election. You want to take a whack at it, or should
I think they point out an interesting irony to the election, which is that, for all the claims about the election of Obama being a sort of, now we're potentially going to live in a post-racial age, that the reason Obama got elected had a lot to do with race. That the reason he won primarily was because he increased the percentage of the vote that African Americans went to the Democrats, which doesn't sound possible, but it did go from 88% to 95%.
Yeah.
And more importantly, the Hispanic vote overwhelmingly went, increased by 12 percentage points for Obama.
Right.
And that had he only improved those groups as much as he improved the white vote for Obama, which is, I think, something like 2%, he would have lost this election.
Right.
And
so the white vote went from 41 to 43. Yeah.
Right. And so for all the talk about how this being, we're beyond race, the only reason Obama wins the election is precisely because, to some extent, potentially, of racial identification.
Right. So a couple of other details on it. That's the essence of the article. One thing is that it's also true that there was – this is a point that Steve and Charles make. It's also true that there was increased turnout among black and Hispanic voters, but if the turnout had increased, but there hadn't been this shift an increase in the percentage of blacks and percentage of Hispanics voting for Obama over the percentage who had voted for Kerry, the increase in turnout wouldn't have made really any difference. So it was the swing to Obama, that 88 to 95 among blacks and 56 to 67 or 55 to 67 among Hispanics, that was really crucial. Another thing is, you know, there was a huge amount, as we all know, a huge amount of discussion about the importance of votes by younger Americans in the election. Right. And one of the things that they observed was actually on the turnout among younger voters, really nothing special about it, although two-thirds of voters under 30, I guess it is, 25, under 30. Two-thirds voted for Obama.
Right.
The one thing that I think is a little misleading, tendentious, maybe overstated about so their line, the sort of summary line for them is Obama won because of race.
Right.
Shift black, shift Hispanic, and the white shift is only from 41 to 43. But another piece of this is that in the 80s, the Democrats were getting about 38% of the white vote.
Mm-hmm.
In this election, Obama gets 43% of the white vote. 43, that 5% shift over the 80s to Obama is, probably about 4 or 5 million voters, something like that. So it's there are many more votes there than he's getting from black voters and Hispanic voters. So I think the idea that there is some kind of, post-racial, we're all in this together, just us Americans here, not red, not blue states, just America, whatever, the song. I think that the force behind that point is that, you did get some shift on the part of white voters away from this a pattern of voting Republican in the 80s, and Obama does do better not only than Kerry but also than Gore or Clinton. The thing that's, I think, the downside of this, again, a point that Steve and Charles make, I think this is a real source of concern, is, so suppose you're a basic Republican strategist and you're thinking about the 2012 election already.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people are.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, look, black vote goes 88 to 95, Hispanic up to 67%. Younger Hispanic voters are registering like crazy registering Democrat like crazy. Where are you going to be? You're not going to pull black voters away from Obama in 2012. Right. Not that likely you're going to pull Hispanic voters away because of the position of the party on immigration. Mm-hmm. Not just that, but that among other things. So what are you going to do? Where's the soft spot, the sweet spot, if you're a Republican looking to put? It's among white voters. And so there's going to be, this is the worry here is that there's going to be the next sort of enterprising young Kevin Phillips, emerging Republican majority guy sitting around saying, you got to do the racial wedge in 2012. And in a way that fight's sort of shaping up already. This was, the criticisms that Colin Powell was making of Sarah Palin just a couple of weeks ago about having been brought up in the South Bronx and having come out with pretty good values, even though he wasn't from a small camp.
I would say a couple things on this. First, if I'm the GOP, you do not under any circumstances write off the Hispanic vote anytime soon. And I think the way in which you potentially appeal to that, and this will be the interesting question, is presumably the way you're going to try to appeal to Hispanics are twofold. First, try to, again, make yourself the party of entrepreneurship, because that will appeal to immigrant groups, obviously. And second, appeal to cultural issues, which, again, where, a lot of Hispanics might identify more with the GOP than they do with the Democrats. So I think there are alternative formulations that you can use.
You could be the party of homeownership also.
Yeah, well, let's
say that. Sorry.
I'm not sure anyone wants to be known as the party of that right now.
That was a joke.
Yes, okay.
That was a successful joke.
Right. I take your point. But, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, in some ways, what you're suggesting is almost the national version of what Pete Wilson did in 94 in California, which I was there for. Mm-hmm. Where Wilson runs on this Prop 187 issue, you know, which was going to deny benefits to illegal immigrants.
Right.
And this really worked. It worked dramatically well. It polarized, you know, California voters. A lot of the whites went out in favor of Wilson. Wilson was able to defeat who I know, I can't remember who his Democratic challenger was. I remember she was the treasurer. But anyway, you know, wins. But it's a Pyrrhic victory. It's the last victory, prior to Schwarzenegger, it was the last Republican victory for 10 years. And it alienated a tremendous amount. I mean, if I'm a GOP strategist, you know, the demographic trends aren't such that pursuing that kind of strategy, it might win you one election, it might win you two.
Right.
But it's an even more extreme version, you can argue, of the Rovian base argument that's been made for the previous 8 years. So I'm not sure that works terribly well. That would be one reaction I would have. The second is that, you know, back to the piece, I think I have two other takes to it. The first is that in some ways it's actually not a fair piece to Obama. Because there are kind of two ways we can look at this. The first is how people voted, and the second is how the candidates ran the races.
Yes.
And I think it's to Obama's credit that he actually, you can argue, regardless of how people voted, Obama did, with the exception of the Reverend Wright speech, run a campaign that was largely devoid of talk about race.
Yes.
And, you know, as a Republican, I applaud that. That was a good thing to see. It was good to see someone who ostensibly was trying to embody the Martin Luther King line about being judged by the content of his character rather than the color of his skin. And so
applaud it as a Republican. Are there other capacities in which you don't applaud it?
Yes, no, you're right. I mean, my point is that, you know, Republicans have always liked that.
We're trying to get past this category politics.
Right.
Racial categories.
And so in that sense, you know, it's almost unfair that Obama get, you know, tagged with this, you know, racial line when it was not something that he, promoted in any way whatsoever. So I think in that sense he actually deserves, you know, a little bit of a break. That said, the real issue in this campaign, and they do identify this, it's even less than Hispanics. It's the fact that, you know, African Americans and over, you know, in 95% of them voted for the black candidate.
Yes.
Now this is the first time, you know, you've had a truly viable, you know, you had a major party nominee, so I think that's particularly fair. I don't know necessarily agree though that it's good for the health of this country that you have that kind of split in terms of voting.
Yes.
And this is where and I'm not sure where this goes from here. But, you know, one of my long-term hopes is that because Obama won, you know, maybe 20 years from now, the African-American vote actually winds up splitting, you know, even just 60-40 or you know, 70-30, you know, with the GOP candidate picking up that percentage. Because I want to see more of these groups in play, frankly.
It would be a good thing, and if the Republican Party completely transformed itself to be able to win some of that support. I think,
but it would also. It would also be good if African Americans looked beyond race as a reason to vote for someone.
I agree with you about that. I think it would be good if. I'm just adding that I think it would be good if, as happened with white voters in this race, in this campaign, that a bunch of white voters look beyond race. And that's not always been, you know, the way with white voters.
No, and if you know.
My colleagues did one of these, you know, did an internet survey and in which people were asked if you would, you know, where the, you know, black voters were asked if they would vote for Obama because he was black, and white voters were asked right. if they would vote against Obama. And you could be anonymous. Mm-hmm. So there, the thought was that you're getting an honest answer. And it is true that 75% of the black respondents said they thought that the fact that Obama was black was a reason for voting for him.
Right.
That said, the increase in for Obama for over Kerry is from 88% to 95%.
Yes, true.
So you had 88% voting for a white Democratic candidate. And the fact is that you got a Democrat running in an economy that's, sing the tune, the economy's a disaster, you got two wars, you have an incredibly unpopular president. What's surprising is
that a Democrat should have won this race no matter what.
A Democrat should have won this. So yeah. if what number would you have predicted among black voters?
Yeah.
Voting Democratic, given that they voted 88%
absolutely.
91%. That said, I certainly agree, but that's part of the. I agree with your general point, and I think that's part of the thing that's a matter of concern here. I think that the fight within the Republican Party over the next 4 years is going to be a fight between people who think something like what you're thinking, that you want to be the party of entrepreneurship and you want to be a party in particular that appeals to Hispanic voters, where Republicans were. Traditionally more successful, and then a bunch of people who see some very, very low-hanging fruit among the white voters.
Right.
That 43% of white voters, and somebody is going to get in the meeting and say, if we could drive that back from 43% to where it was in the 1980s, 38%, we win.
I have to say, a lot of this talk, we've seen a lot of this in the last couple months about, what does the GOP do for 2012? I have to say that there's almost a mindset where people are forgetting that the GOP is no longer the agenda setter on this. The fact is the race that the Republican runs in 2012 is almost entirely dependent on how well the Obama administration does the first 3 years in office. And so if they wind up, and there are ways in which, anyone who knows, enough about political business cycles to know that there are ways in which Obama is primed almost even now to wind up guaranteeing his reelection, because you got to think that 3 years from now the economy is going to look better than it does now. And if that's
you got to hope anyway,
you what
do you think?
And if that's the case,
that's
the case, it's going to be very, very hard for a Republican to win, just because when he runs in 3 years' time, Obama is now the president. A lot of the issues that he got tagged with this time around are not going to be they're going to be non-issues. 3 years from now, no one is going to give a shit about Bill Ayers or Jeremiah White in 2011, 2012. So,
all true.
Yeah.
But now I'm not saying that this is that the racial appeal, the coded racial appeal by a Republican candidate is a winning strategy.
You just think it'll be the strategy.
There's going to be a very, very strong temptation to go down that road. And what you just said, which I think has a lot of force to it. Is not going to diminish the chances of a candidate going down that strategy, because somebody is going to get up and say, look, you can't run on, the economy or on, entrepreneurship, and certainly not on homeownership. You got to find some other way to do it, and it's got to be social issues, and the social issues extending to crime and,
this also depends,
it's a concern.
I would say this also depends on who winds up running, and this is why, I don't know enough about him, but Bobby Jindal is interesting in this instance.
Absolutely.
Because Jindal is someone who could run on the cultural arguments. He's profoundly, socially conservative, but no one would accuse him, obviously, of, running a race-based campaign.
Right. So this is a reason. So what I'm saying gives a prediction that there are going to be a bunch of people who might otherwise have found Jindal an attractive candidate who are going to back away from him because he's not going to be seen as having being able to make this appeal. But, who knows?
Yeah, we'll see on this.
I'm not going to attach a probability to this, but I think it's a concern and something to watch out for. I guess we had one other issue that
To close out, it's fitting, as we are, I think less than a month of the Bush administration. Newsweek magazine asked a bunch of artists and to basically try to identify the key cultural artifacts that best epitomize the Bush years. One person argued that the television show Battlestar Galactica best represents, is the best cultural artifact. Someone said Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, I think, is a book. I don't remember what the movie was.
Black Hawk Down.
Black Hawk Down, yes. Do you have any, thoughts about this?
Well, the person who picked Black Hawk Down, I've watched Black Hawk Down a few times.
Yes.
In fact, just saw it about 3 weeks ago again. I like it. It was a kind of, as if it were a kind of celebration of war. I think that's the person who picked it said, it turned out that way. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's a celebration of the kind of band of brothers aspect of war, not of the politicians or national goals or anything like that. It's a bunch of people you don't leave anybody behind. That's the story. There are a few things about the movie, though, that I suppose make it maybe even more emblematic of the Bush years. One is there was nothing about the history of Somalia in the thing. It was a complete distortion. There were no Somalians in the thing. The people who were in the movie didn't look anything like Somalians. That is, the alleged Somalians didn't look anything like Somalians. They didn't talk anything like Somalians. Moreover, the hero of the movie is serving time for rape of a child, and he's presented
not at the time of the movie, but yes.
Yeah, not at the time, right? So, but he was being celebrated as a great figure, and a bunch of people, including his wife or maybe his ex-wife, were a little bit worried about the celebration because his name was changed for the sake of the movie.
This is the Ewan McGregor character, right?
Yeah, I guess that's right. The desk guy
who wound up going out, right?
The desk jockey who goes out. He's
let me ask a different question,
time.
Josh.
Yeah.
Would you suggest an alternative? I have an idea in mind.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
Do you have
go
an
ahead. You're a...
I mean, I think the key thing about the difficulty with this, and there's been debates about this on the blogs. Kevin Drum suggests, for example, that in terms of TV shows, 24 is much better than Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
And I think one of the problems is, you need to come up with a cultural artifact that different ideologies can interpret in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem is there's not a lot of agreement about the Bush administration. They're incredibly unpopular, but he's unpopular for different reasons.
Yeah.
So my choice would be that you need a movie that people can interpret in radically different ways. Mm-hmm. And my proposal is the movie 300.
Uh-huh.
Because 300, if you are a conservative, in some ways it was a spectacular, crowd-pleasing flick, with lots of, remarkably aestheticized violence, and a message about, the promotion of democracy and the opposition of empire.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen this movie?
I haven't seen it.
This is based on the Frank Miller cartoon. So, if you're a conservative, there are lots of nice, red meat, things to like, Gerard Butler all ripped and saying, a new age is dawning, an age of freedom, and then,
This is the Battle of Thermopylae, is that what?
It's the Battle of Thermopylae.
Yeah.
And the reason liberals can like it is because the movie is in many ways a very big joke. Historically, it's distorted beyond belief. The notion that the Spartans were the chief promoters of democracy would be a great shock to any kind of Greek historian.
Yeah.
It's mostly shot on this blue screen. The extent of homoeroticism in the movie is quite deep. And, by the way, the movie nearly triggered an international incident because the Iranians were convinced that the Bush administration had actually financed the movie. Because the Persians are the bad guys in the flick.
I see.
So in terms of films, I would suggest 300. And in terms of TV shows, someone pointed this out in a blog, and I apologize for not giving precise credit.
Yeah.
We'll end with a plagiarism as well.
Yeah.
Arrested Development, I think, is the emblematic show of the Bush era.
Well, I don't watch any I confess, or I don't know whether an embarrassment or pride. I literally don't watch any television. But on the movie side... We're not looking for best movie of the last 8 years, but emblematic.
No, it can't be the best. It's got to be one that's
hit
my career.
There will be blood. Ruthlessness, violence, perversion of religion for money, perversion of everything for money. And this is really what makes it emblematic of the Bush years, with a mixture of total father-son craziness.
I will leave it this way. I understand that. I will also say I'm less of a fan than you. I think it's also emblematic of the Bush era, and that it has possibly one of the worst endings ever of a movie.
Right. No, I thought you were saying before the ending of the Bush period administration is better, at least on foreign policy. But I agree.
Exactly.
With
yes. You know, but on the financial front, not so hot.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's right. I can't.
So why don't we? You know, we will close with that.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure, Josh.
Nice to talk to you, Dan.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye bye now.
Bye.